You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host. It's our 14th year talking about beer and many other things from the food system on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to go around the room and introduce our guests. We are getting ready for the Craft Malt Conference, which is March 16th to 18th, 2023 in Portland, Maine. So let's go around the room. Everyone's going to introduce themselves. Jesse?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks again for having us back. I'm really excited to be here. I'm Jesse Bussard, the Executive Director of the Craft Maltsters Guild.
Well, thanks so much for working on this and keeping it going. This is our second episode since January, previewing the Craft Malt Conference. And Rob?
Hey, everyone. My name is Rob Arnold. I am the president of a company called Advanced Spirits and also the author of the book, The Terroir of Whiskey.
Which seems like it's got a new cult following. I just ordered mine.
Oh, yeah? Well, tell me how it is.
Oh, yeah. And then we got Mark.
Yeah, I'm Mark Sorrells. I'm from Cornell University. I'm a professor of plant breeding and genetics, and I lead the Small Grains Breeding and Genetics Project there.
Wow. Well, this is quite a lineup, Jesse. These are some of the star speakers from the Craft Malt Conference that's coming up in March in Portland. Just to give our listeners a little, you know, intro, what was it like putting together the speakers for this conference? I know that it took about 3 or 4 years to actually get the conference actually to happen because of the pandemic, but the lineup of speakers is freaking unbelievable.
Yeah, so the really great thing about being in the craft malting industry is there's a lot of really exciting things happening with malt and just grains right now in the industry, both, you know, in the distilling world and in the brewing world and on the malting and plant breeding side as well. So there's no, you know, I was never at a loss for topics to pull from. And I really strive to make sure there's a nice assortment of talks that'll really fit a really wide array of attendees. So, you know, everyone from the head maltster to the marketing director to a brewer who's, you know, maybe looking to expand their knowledge about craft malt, or a distiller who wants to, you know, perfect their craft using malted barley. So there's really a lot of opportunities for people from across the supply chain at our conference, which I think is unique.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, my intro to regional grains goes way back over 12 years ago to June Russell and the Grow NYC Green Markets. And they were just teasing the waters on regional grains and creating standards for the bakers in their markets. And I think along the way, I heard about Mr. Mark Sorrells at Cornell. Mark, you want to give us a little intro about the work that you've done at Cornell, and particularly with New York and barley, and how long you've been in this field?
Well, I've been here a while. I came here right out of a postdoc at Wisconsin in 1978. We got into barley. We've been testing mostly feed barley up until about 2012, 2013. And then we started testing malting barley because the New York State Legislature passed the Farm Brewery Bill. It gave tax and marketing incentives to farm breweries, but they have to use New York grown ingredients. So I started getting calls and emails asking what malting barley varieties to grow. And unfortunately, there was no malting barley being grown in New York, and we hadn't done any research on it before that. So we convinced them to support us to develop a malting barley breeding program, and that was the start of it in 2016.
That's great. And you guys came up with a New York variety that's doing really well.
Well,
how is that Excelsior doing?
We've been pleasantly surprised. I was down at Hudson Valley Malt a few weeks ago and got to see one of my varieties being floor malted there, and it looked beautiful. It was just, we just had a wonderful season for growing malting barley in New York. The seed is really nice and bright and high germination percentages. But we released two varieties. We did release them in record time because we knew that farmers needed a variety that was adapted to this region and could tolerate the climatic stresses like pre-harvest sprouting, foliar diseases, Fusarium head blight. And we released two varieties in 2021. One was called Excelsior Gold, and the other one was called CU198. So those varieties were in commercial use now for 2 years, small quantities a couple of years ago, and then larger quantities this past year. And so far, both the farmers and the maltsters have been happy with them.
That's great. I know it was big news when they came out, and I'm looking forward to talking to you more on the show about the conference. Rob, tell us about you. So I know that you were a distiller, but you're working more in whiskey, right?
Yeah, so I grew up in Kentucky, and I'm a third-generation member of the whiskey industry. So I grew up around it. I never thought I was going to go into whiskey until I got to grad school and started homebrewing, and then it kind of spiraled out of control from there. But in 2011, I joined Firestone and Robertson Distilling Company in Fort Worth, and I was the first employee there. And our brand was TX Whiskey, and I was there for 10 years. So I had a lot of different roles over the years. My marketing title was master distiller, but I had all sorts of pursuits beyond turning valves and knobs in the distillery. And one of those was, continuing my science background. And so I actually was able to complete a PhD in plant breeding while I was at TX Whiskey, with Seth Murray, who's the corn breeder and geneticist at Texas A&M. And we pursued a project around the idea of how terroir impacts the flavor in whiskey. We looked at bourbon whiskey specifically, so a corn-based product. And this idea of terroir meaning how the genetics of the corn variety, the environment in which the variety is growing in, as well as the interaction of those two, how that variety expresses flavor through its environment, trying to establish some sort of idea of how those three effects, the genetics, the environment, and the interaction can impact flavor in whiskey. And so I'm a bad excuse for a plant breeder, or at least I've never done a cross in the field. I've barely done any kind of farming. So the fact that I've got a PhD in plant breeding is, I'm much more of a distiller and flavor chemist, but it was something that was really interesting to pursue, looking at there's so many varieties of corn that are out there, and this is true for barley, wheat, and rye and other grain types, but especially within the bourbon industry, everyone for decades now has just jumped to using number two yellow dent corn, maybe number one if they've cleaned it well. But the number doesn't mean anything as far as flavor. It's this yellow dent corn variety is a commodity, is very narrow genetic diversity compared to what else is out there in the corn species. And so to really take a step back and say, well, you don't have to just use yellow dent corn when you make bourbon and explore what that can mean, was really interesting. And I think the same thing is, I know the same thing is happening within barley and for beer and to a lesser extent in rye and wheat, but there's still movements towards exploring the diversity of varieties that exist within the species, and then how they can be tailored or how the local flavor based on where that variety is grown can be very distinct to a place. So a lot of that background and research and hands-on experience in the distillery led me to write a book called The Terroir of Whiskey, which I guess chronicled the science that we did when I was at TX and in grad school, as well as some of the kind of travel adventures I got to go do and to visit places in Ireland and Scotland and New York and Kentucky, and visit distilleries and some malt houses that were, you know, that are really trying to pursue this idea of local flavor.
You know, before we go too deep, I would like you guys to talk a little bit about just what farm to glass is, and you know, especially Mark, with you were just at, you know, Hudson Valley Malt House, and you're seeing the malt, you know, variety of barley. Do you go all the way and taste it in the glass, and are you able to tell the difference?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question. I haven't actually done a controlled scientific evaluation of that particular quality, but when we were at the New York State Empire Barley and Malt Conference in December, we had a brewer from the Culinary Institute of America who brewed with my Excelsior Gold and had samples there for people to try, and it had a really wonderful Pilsner flavor to it. It was quite tasty.
It was probably Hutch, right? Hutch Kujman.
No, you got it.
All right. And then what about for you, Rob? Yeah, farm to glass.
Well, as far as, you know, can you, like what we did through our research was actually this controlled experiment and grew different varieties on different farms, and actually in the lab processed them into whiskey and did chemical analysis and sensory analysis. And yeah, we could break it down to, you know, the flavor of corn was impacted this much by the variety and this much by where it was grown and this much by how those two things intertwine with each other. So, I mean, you can, you know, I think the idea of, can you taste the impact of grain variety or growing environment in beer and whiskey? I think the science, and it's not just our group that has done work here that's been published. I mean, all the data out there that has been published through peer-reviewed journals shows that the answer is yes, it does impact the flavor. And so I think where it gets really interesting is to move past that debate, because that debate's kind of worn out, and talk about, well, how much does it impact flavor, or how much can that grain-to-glass movement really be used to tailor or to capture new, forgotten local flavors? You know, can we kind of get past talking about it in general broad strokes and really get to some specifics, the way I think the wine industry does a great job of being able to show how certain flavors are very specific to this wine region or this grape variety? And that's where I would like to see our industry go as well with grain, is being able to really pinpoint some of those unique aspects that are from a variety or from a region, from a growing environment.
Yeah, the person who has done the most work with flavor in barley is Pat Hayes at Oregon State University.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
And he's actually done quite a lot of controlled tests to find out if different barley varieties and different growing regions affect the flavor.
Yeah, and I think. What's been really cool to see what he's done, you know, what there's been some really cool work out of, you know, Pat Hayes had done some cool work with whiskey too, through Waterford Distillery and a guy named Dr. Justin Herb. And I think what's interesting to see is when you do, just if you try to analyze all the flavor compounds present, there's a litany of flavor compounds present in beer or whiskey. But if you try to really peel it back and say, okay, well, which ones are actually important for flavor, and you can start to narrow it down through specific techniques. And then it gets interesting to me, because then you can start to maybe really, you know, how do you mingle the agronomy, the plant breeding, and the brewing distilling process to really go after the flavors that you're looking for, that are specific to your variety or your growing environment.
How different is it when you're talking about barley and grains for whiskeys versus beer?
I don't really have an answer for that. Do you, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, the flavor compounds themselves are usually conserved across the different, whether it's, you know, I, this is something I thought about in my book a lot, and I did the comparison of whiskey to wine, and I got some kind of people up front questioning, well, is that really a fair analogy? But the flavor compounds that are important for wine, or almost all of them, are also very important in whiskey, and the same thing applies to beer. What you're talking about more is variations and concentrations among the same flavor compounds or the same flavor compound classes. I mean, it still comes down to, you know, esters and terpenes and phenols and aldehydes and, you know, the ones that humans are sensitive to. It's usually the case that, you know, isoflavone acetate, for example, is a very common flavor compound. It smells like banana that is in beer and wine and whiskey and all sorts of other stuff. And so that's the nice part about the research is you can, I think it does translate nicely across different styles, whether you mean spirit styles, alcohol styles, you know, styles within the ale category, whatever it is. I think there's a lot of nice overlap that, so that, you know, you can apply something you found in wine to whiskey or to beer as an example.
Yeah.
The maltsters I've talked to say that they are really trying to avoid off flavors more than specific compounds, but
yeah,
because they don't want off flavors in their product.
Yeah, and that's been common for really, you know, the breeding programs for malting barley. It's the flavors always, from what I understand, it's something that's considered at the end of the process to make sure that an off flavor isn't coming from that specific variety. I would love to see us one day get to the point where flavor is a trait pursued in the breeding program. It's a very complicated trait and not one that's easy to breed for, but I think if you're focusing on specific flavor compounds, it's possible.
Rob, what's it like developing, you know, barley for Texas versus New York? You guys can both talk about that. It's a broad question, but I think it's a good thing for the show.
Yeah, Mark's probably better. I've never, I have not ever worked with barley in the field. Like I said, I'm actually a pretty star excuse for a plant breeder, but so I'm going to let Mark, I might let Mark take that one first.
I think most of the barley is grown in Western states and Western Canada provinces and, these are drier climates. I think wheat is predominantly the grain that's grown, small grain that's grown in Texas. And I don't know much about barley production in Texas. Most of the barley is, like I said, has been grown in Western states and the Western prairies of Canada. But we realized that when we started growing malting barley in New York, that those varieties just are not very well adapted. We have a lot more kinds of abiotic stress and biotic stress here. And so it requires really a different emphasis in the breeding program. I think we're going to see more and more barley growing, being grown in non-traditional areas because the craft beer industry really likes to have local products and so do consumers.
Yeah, I can confirm there are two craft malt houses in Texas.
Oh, are there? So
there is barley being grown there as well as wheat and other small grains. Tex Malt is probably the largest craft maltster there, and they work largely with distillers, which is really cool to see. So, there's lots of barley being grown in Texas. Maybe not as much as New York, but it's there.
Yeah,
that's good to know.
We TX was involved in that early on. So Tex Malt was actually down the street from our first distillery. I mean, you could walk there and be there in a few minutes.
That's convenient.
Yeah. So I got to know Austin and Chase there pretty well over the years, the two founders. And they actually are the sole provider of barley, whether it's malted or not. although at this point all of it is malted, that comes through to TX Whiskey for making their bourbons and rye whiskeys. And all that barley that they use is sourced from the farm that provides TX with corn, wheat, and rye as well, and that's Sawyer Farms. And Sawyer Farms is maybe 40 minutes south of Fort Worth. And
nice.
John Sawyer's had a lot of success growing Thoroughbred Six Row. I think he's grown some, done pretty well with Calypso. That's a two row, I think, right? So it's definitely possible. I think he's had some years better than others, definitely. And there's, the further south you go in Texas, the hotter and wetter it is. And sometimes I think there's been more of an issue growing it further south, but here in the northern part of the state, and same with other small grains. I mean, you're right. Wheat was already established here, but rye, whether it's Elbon, has done okay here. We've actually been able to grow some of the hybrids, the Brissetto and Bonos here in Texas. But whether it's barley or rye, it would definitely benefit from some breeding efforts to tailor the varieties to the area. It's still a struggle compared to wheat or corn. So, but yeah, I mean, the Tex Malt crew is great. They're able to work with a lot of great farmers and source a lot of great local barley and other and rye and wheat, and I think they even malt some corn. So,
Jesse, what are some of the questions that you think will be happening at the conference? And you probably have a couple questions.
I think Rob's gonna have a groupie following of craft maltsters who want them to sign his copy of their book of his book. I think that's gonna be a thing. I also think it's kind of cool that the fact that the two speakers that are joining me on this interview are the first and the last speakers in the conference. So we've got the first and the last in our lineup on the same conversations. So that's kind of quirky. But yeah, I'm really excited about just really everybody getting back together again. It's been 3 years since our community has had a conference together like this. So it's long overdue. And I think there's going to be a lot of excitement and energy at the craft malt or at the Malt Cup award ceremony. That's always an exciting event because we announce the winners for each of the categories. And this year we had four categories, which is the most we've ever had. And we'll be doing the best of show judging in Portland, Maine, on the 16th, and then announcing the winners on the 17th that night. So that's always a really fun and exciting evening. It'll be great to see who gets crowned this year's Malt Cup winner. Best of show.
Jesse, are the maltsters that have won top prizes, are they seeing an uptick in interest in their malts and in sales from brewers and distillers?
We do have a few craft malt houses that have, you know, been repeat winners, and they do use those accolades to promote themselves as award-winning maltsters, you know. So there's definitely people using it as a point of, you know, to set their product apart, which is really cool.
That's great.
That's something that I'm really interested in hearing about is, I think it's along those lines, is how has the consumer been responding to this movement over the past couple of years? I mean, when I was an active distiller, I was in the thick of this, but I mean, I really, at this point, what I do is not distilling day, you know, the day job. I run an investment fund where we focus on startup whiskey brands, and so I work with a lot of brands. And
is that called liquid assets, Rob?
Exactly. So we have a lot of, we have a lot of
liquid assets.
There you go. I don't know. I'm away from the day in and day out of being in the middle of the distillery and of a lab. you know, how much is the consumer responding to this idea of local grain, of specific flavors that come from a place, that come from a variety. I still completely believe that this is going to continue to be a point of differentiation and something that the consumer does care about. But I'm interested to hear from the brewers and maltsters and distillers that are there, just how the market's been responding to the idea when it's used in the marketing. Because in the end, if the consumer's not
great part of the conference,
if the consumer's not picking up on it, if the consumer doesn't,
I think we're seeing, you know, we've personally, the Guild has seen an uptick in production over the past 3 years. And we did a recent survey last year where we found that just in the past 3 years, there's been a 60% increase in production. And, you know, we've also seen numbers of malt houses increase. We continue to hear about more and more operations expanding or new developing malt houses getting close to opening. So there's a lot of growth happening, and I feel like that growth wouldn't be there if the interest wasn't there. So we're, you know, I think brewers and distillers are looking more at craft malt for a number of reasons, but, you know, I think climate change and just then the rising cost of everything is really one driver. Craft malt's just becoming the price of malt is high enough now that even the commodity malt in some cases is the same price as craft malt.
Oh wow.
And you know, that was reported in a Good Beer Hunting article recently. We're seeing things like that happening in certain areas. Not everywhere necessarily, but you know, there's people looking to source locally, reduce their impact, or there's people looking to take advantage of that differentiation through, you know, the local terroir and connection to place. And craft malt is just uniquely positioned for that. But also American single malt whiskey, we can't forget about that.
Jesse, just talking about states and production, what are the top states right now that you're seeing the craft malt coming out of? And well, in terms of the acceptance, because I know, like, in my mind, just from doing this conference, I see Maine, I see New York, I see North Carolina as three East Coast states where they have strong regional malt.
Yeah, I would say Michigan's another. And then, you know, the Pacific Northwest, Washington, Oregon, California, those states are really a great place for craft maltsters. And, you know, but I would say that there's a lot of interest and desire for more local grains in the Midwest, and that's where I hope more growth happens.
Wow, hey, we're going to go take a step back here. I want to ask Mark, just going back a few years, Mark, how hard was it, and what were some of the stories you could tell about the early days, even 8 or 10 years ago? When you didn't quite have the New York State barleys, how did you talk to farms about taking it on, and how important is it for the small farms to do small grains like this?
Well, it was a challenge. Before I get into the details, I'd just like to point out that in the year 1879, New York was number two in barley production in the United States. That all changed, of course, with the opening of the Erie Canal and Prohibition. Getting back to your question there, Jimmy, we are fortunate to have an outstanding cooperative extension service here in New York, and they were instrumental in training farmers on how to grow this new crop. It's not like growing feed barley, for sure. And when we brought in those varieties from other parts of the U.S. and Europe, especially the ones from Western Canada and the U.S., they turned out to be extremely susceptible to pre-harvest sprouting. And consequently, farmers lost their entire crop of malting barley in several times in those first few years. And some of the farmers just gave up. They said, I'm not going to fool around with it. But fortunately, we found that some of the varieties, particularly the ones from Europe, had some pre-harvest sprouting resistance. And so those varieties were grown quite a bit. They have a bit of a different malting profile than the Western U.S. and Western Canada varieties do, but the maltsters seem to be happy with them and be able to make them work. But we really needed a variety that combined both foliar disease resistance and pre-harvest sprouting resistance with good yield and good malt quality. And that takes a breeding program that is specifically targeting a particular growing region. Even though we were able to make it work with the varieties from other parts of the country and the world, they weren't perfect and they weren't ideal. So that's why we launched our own program to try to meet those needs of the maltsters and brewers.
That's great. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. This is our 14th year of broadcasting weekly many different shows about food, farming, beer, and whiskey on heritageradionetwork.org. You become a member, again, heritageradionetwork.org. So we're doing another Craft Malt Conference pre-show with Jesse Buzzard, the executive director, and two experts, Mark Sorrells and Rob Arnold. So we're having a great conversation. And Mark was just talking a little bit about the challenge and some of the early days of getting farms in New York to adopt, to taking on small grains. Mark, you know, New York to me is, you know, my home state and what I know from drinking and alcohol. And, you know, guys like Jason Saylor and Strong Rope.
Oh, yeah.
There are some brewers that live by, you know, New York ingredients. And there's others that are want to embrace it. You know, they might have a small system where they're using, which is their farm brewery, and they're trying to focus on New York ingredients, and they may have a larger system that's not the farm brewery. So I see a lot of, but I think that you guys have done a great job in that. I think across New York State, the brewers know, you know, what local is and what local malt is. Are you proud of yourself?
Well, not me particularly, but I'm very impressed with with some of the breweries like Strong Rope being able to use 100% New York grown ingredients. I think that's pretty impressive, and it takes an outstanding maltster and brewer to be able to use local ingredients because they change every year and they're different from different farms. So it's a challenge that only the most skillful maltsters and brewers can manage to deal with. So that's sort of I think that's one of the most important aspects of growing and brewing, malting and brewing locally, is to deal with the variation from farm to farm and year to year.
Yeah, no, it's great. And then you said you were just up at Hudson Valley Malt with Dennis. Yep. He's also grown. Again, what tell us your experience of being there when your variety of barley is being malted.
Yeah, well, he collaborates with Ken Migliarelli Farm, and Ken's a good farmer. He's only been growing barley for a few years, but he's a very conscientious farmer. He gets the barley out of the field on time, cleans it, and Dennis appreciates the high quality of grain that he gets from Ken. When I was there, it was a field to pint tour organized by Cooperative Extension of Ulster County. And when we visited Hudson Valley Mall, by the way, their tasting room is beautiful. You really ought to try to get there to see their tasting room. It's right, and there's windows. You can see the floor malting going on from the tasting room. And they gave me a rake, and I went out there and raked some of my own barley.
I've been there too. I was there in 2016 when when Migliarelli's farm was just starting out.
Yeah.
With barley.
Yeah. I think a couple of Dennis's sons do a lot of the work there now. That's a beautiful facility. It's worth visiting if you get a chance.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you. I know that in New York State, people talk about the work you're doing, and I'm looking forward to hearing your full presentation at the Craft Malt Conference. Talking about Craft Malt Conference presentations, Rob, you want to preview your keynote? I don't want to give the whole thing away, but you know, there is a lot of buzz about your book, The Terroir of Whiskey, and what do you have a few notes from your keynote presentation?
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about, to start, I guess, what this idea of terroir, I mean, what exactly is it, and why has it been debated within whiskey, at least, and I've seen it debated equally and beer, and that, for that matter, sometimes in wine. But maybe try to move past that debate of does it matter for flavor and talk about some of the more important points that I think are, you know, yes, it does impact flavor, but how do we really leverage it to create distinct beers, distinct whiskeys that the consumer recognizes as something special? And to do that, I think working with plant breeders and agronomists, we can't go down this path and sacrifice the things that we need for sustainability and yield. But at the same time, we don't need to just ignore flavor along the way. I think it really does start back at that point with the seed and with the farming practices. And I would love to see us get to a point where consumers are recognizing specific varieties, like Mark's, like the way that the industry for whiskey, at least, still to an extent recognizes Golden Promise and Maris Otter. And within corn, there's Bloody Butcher. And I would like to see the consumers really understand become some of these varieties become not just words that ain't names that the industry knows, but that the consumer knows and understands, and maybe even get to the point where regions or growing regions are understood to be special for the flavors that you can that are being coaxed out of them. But I want to talk about how do we get to that point? Like, you know, how do we get past some of the debates that exist at the consumer level? Does it even matter? And get to the point where we're really able to show why these grains and these malts are so special in creating distinct products. And so I think science is an important tool in that.
Rob, I saw in New York, you know, the focus on rye, and then there's a lot of good rye whiskey being made by small distillers in New York. When I think about bourbon, unless I'm really thinking about it, I don't ever think about corn. And I remember years ago when Kings County Distillery was first distilling in New York, they only had they called it corn eau de vie, or like a moonshine. Yeah. It was probably the first time I really thought that, wow, the base of bourbon is what's 50% corn or something like that.
Yeah.
So how, you know, how do you talk more about the corn? And
well, I mean, I think that's,
you know, what are the varieties that you want to use in your bourbon, you know?
Yeah, but I think what you just said is a good example of the challenges in front of us. The consumers at this point, I don't think a lot of them wouldn't understand or know, or maybe they don't even care that much that corn is the primary ingredient in bourbon, much less care about what variety or where that corn came from. But you compare that to the wine industry, and people go and choose wines based on the variety. Do they want a Merlot or Cab or Syrah or Pinot Grigio, or based on the region? And I think that's where there's this dichotomy that, how do we get to the point where we're, you know, we are able to capture the consumer's attention, and to the point where they don't just know that corn, that bourbon's made from corn, as an example, but that they really like the flavor of bourbon made from bloody butcher corn, or from, you know, autophile corn. That's another really cool variety. These are old heirlooms, but, and I don't know if I have the right answer. I have ideas, but I think we're talking about years and years of work, the same way that in wine, it wasn't until a movement out in California that the idea of putting varieties on the labels really changed the way consumers selected wine on the shelf. And so I think there's just a lot of work in front of us, but a lot of interesting stuff that we can tackle along the way. And I definitely don't think the movement's going anywhere, but if I had to, like in whiskey especially, I think the grain usually, and grain meaning malted grains as well, if you're talking about single malt, I think it's probably it plays second fiddle to the importance of the oak cask. I mean, the oak barrel is always sort of the poster child. And so how do we really show how important the grain is, and how different varieties are important in different growing regions, and work with breeders and agronomists?
Yeah, that's cool. That's something I look forward to. Maybe taste some of the corn whiskeys when they're younger too, you know? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you can taste
Jesse. We're going to taste a lot. And also just so you know, if you're at the conference, we're kicking off Thursday on March 16th from 4 to 6. If you're just wandering around Portland, stop by Novare Res, which is the great beer bar of Portland. And some folk from Blue Ox Malt are coordinating with Novare Res. Just a little kind of mixer that's condoned by the conference, where you'll be able to drink some craft malt beers. So that should be going up soon. Mark, I want to go back to the one more thing from your talk. You know, when we talk about breeding, I guess I remember high school biology, and there's Mendel and peas. I think it was peas.
Mm-hmm.
But it said you initiated a high-intensity breeding effort in 2016 to develop the malting barley variety, the Excelsior Gold.
Yeah.
So just tell us, as you know, industry people, what do you do with a high intensity breeding effort? I mean, you're not breeding pigs, so.
Well,
or mice.
I've been at Cornell for 44 years, and so I've learned a few tricks along the way, and ways to speed up the breeding process. And between my graduate students and myself, we used every trick in the book to try to speed up the development of the variety, including winter seed increases in New Zealand, which were key to cutting time in the development process. We also use a new technique called genomic selection, which uses molecular markers across the entire genome to identify those lines that were most promising for yield, disease resistance, and quality. And that combined with early generation testing, we got into the Foundation Seed Production Program in 2020, and we had certified seed production in 2021. So that's about a half to a third of the amount of time that normally takes to develop a malting barley variety.
Amazing.
That's great. And Rob, just another note from your keynote, says, in your keynote, attendees will learn about the science behind metabolites in grain and how these compounds transition through to flavor compounds.
Yeah, it actually kind of goes on what Mark was just talking about too with genomic selection. It's, or at least that could dovetail that way. But I mean, ultimately, all the flavor compounds that are important in beer and whiskey there are metabolite precursors present in the grain that are responsible for them, and they are either convert into the flavor compounds from the malting or mashing or distillation process, or maybe even indirectly through yeast metabolism. But if we're going to actually incorporate flavor into breeding programs, into agronomy, to try to capture specific flavors, like you're talking about, we have to know what we're looking for. And it's too low throughput to try to analyze, in my opinion, try to analyze the beer, or the whiskey itself, especially whiskey. We have to have the ability to focus on the metabolite precursors and the breeding programs if we want to actually breed for flavor. And so, like Mark was saying with genetic selection, they have markers for things like yield and resistance. Well, could there be markers for the flavors we want as well? And so that's what that idea of a metabolite precursor is. It's just the, you know, things like carotenoids and fatty acids are in the grain kernels, and those turn into really delicious flavors like terpenes and chocolatey aldehydes. So that's what I'm talking about there.
Jesse, at the conference, will we be able to taste beer and whiskeys, or is it just talking?
No, there will also be. Yes, there will be. Yes. There will be beer and whiskeys made with craft malt available at the conference. I know for sure there will be a lot of Allagash beer, since we're kind of in their backyard. So expect that. And Blue Ox Malt is actually helping us to get some beer lined up for the event too. So expect some great surprises there.
That's great. We're gonna talk craft malt and drink Maine. I love it.
Yes. We're really gonna have that a good time. It's gonna be good.
And you have some great questions and great guests here. I think we'll close it out by, I think that Rob, I bet you have a question for Mark, because I know that you studied under one of his former students. We got to ask Mark a question, because this, you know, there's not too many scientists that I know of in the Northeast who've done what he's done.
I mean, do you, maybe it's just following up on what we're just talking about, but do you think there's a path for us to actually incorporate flavor into the breeding programs, whether it's through genetic markers or actually chemical markers themselves, you know, using techniques like mass spec or
I think so.
NIR to measure the metabolites in the grain?
Well, I would be optimistic, Rob, because we can predict complex traits now already.
Right.
And if we know what those aromatics are and their precursors and where they're located in the genome, we can use a few markers to select for the ones we're interested in, or we can do whole genome selection for some quality that you're able to measure on the finished product. So I think it's definitely possible, and it's going to take some work. It's going to take some work, but I would be optimistic that we can eventually get there.
Yeah. That's great.
Well, listen, great show. If anybody's drinking anything, let me know. I'm drinking today's, in honor of the conference, I'm drinking all regional grains. So shout out to Exhibit A Brewing in Framingham, Massachusetts. They've been a longtime supporter of Valley Malt, who's not too far from them in Massachusetts. And I remember there's a farmer out in Finger Lakes, New York, Tor Eschner, who I know you know, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
A couple times I visited Tor, and he always had Exhibit A beers, because I guess that's how he got paid. But his Danko, I know he has a Danko rye. Exhibit A, a couple times a year, makes a Danko IPA. And right now I'm drinking one of their standards is called Goody Two Shoes. It's Kolsch style, which I know he's using some Valley malt in that. And again, that's a beer where I really do feel like I can taste the malt, or at least I just think it's a great beer. And for grains themselves, back to June Russell and Grow NYC Grains, and now she's at Glenwood. Years ago, she turned me on to just incorporating, you know, regional grains into my diet. So almost every morning, I eat a multi-grain cereal, which is all kind of sourced and kind of processed through Wild High Farms, who's somewhere upstate. But this is I try to have regional grains every day. So it's in my diet, and you guys have really been influential to me. So thank you. Thanks for everything you guys have done. Jesse, any final words? Conference is coming up. There's still time for people to register.
Yes, there is still time for you to register. We're not closing in-person registration until March 10th. And for the virtual folks, they'll have even more time to register. We'll be keeping virtual registration open through the 15th. So there's a couple different options of ways to participate. For, you know, if you can't make it to Maine, you can still join in for the talks and not miss out on the great, you know, information that we're going to be, that these experts like Rob and Mark are going to be sharing.
Yeah. And I just want to say today it's February 14th. I'm going to say this, even though this will air later, to me, this is my iHeart Craft Malt episode. and for me, more and more when people talk about, you know, what are people drinking, hard seltzer or other products, I think that, you know, craft malt beers are definitely a way, one, for brewers to stand out, and two, just to drink a better product, which is kind of what you want to do, is drink good stuff all the time. And Mark, you want to say anything else before we close out?
Just want to thank Jimmy. I just want to thank you and Jesse for inviting me to be on this program with you. It's a wonderful program, and I really appreciate that.
We're glad you could join us, Mark. It was good to have you.
Yeah, thank you all very much.
Thank you, guys. And thanks, Mark and Jesse. Thank you, Rob, for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our engineer, Armin Spengen, who's going to clean this up. And I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo! Thank you. Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.